TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
Yanis Varoufakis on looming threats in the global economy and the war in Ukraine. Yanis Varoufakis taught economics in Britain, Australia, and his hometown of Athens, Greece. In 2015, he became part of the Greek government. After his resignation, he remained deeply involved in European politics. This is an interview by Steve Paikin on Canadian Public TV on April 21st, 2022. Paikin is host of TVO's public affairs program, The Agenda, and a well-known documentary producer. Here is his introduction of Yanis Varoufakis.
We are living in turbulent economic times with war in Eastern Europe, a global pandemic disrupting supply chains, and inflation rising sharply. Economist Yanis Varoufakis took a turn as Greece's Minister of Finance, founded the new political party Meta 25, and has become a vocal critic of how the global economy was put back together after the Great Recession almost 15 years ago. What does he now see on the horizon amid the period of turmoil we're now encountering? Let's find out, as Yanis Varoufakis joins us now from Athens, Greece. Good to see you again. How are you managing these days?
Personally, all things considered, I'm very well in a very turbulent world. It's very good to see you again, Steve.
Thank you for saying so. Let me start with the worst story in the world today, namely what's happening between Russia and Ukraine. Do you believe the sanctions that many Western countries have put on Russia are working?
Yes and no. They're working in the sense that they are damaging majestically the Russian economy. The Russian people are suffering and will continue increasingly to suffer from them. There may be a loss of national income in Russia of up to 20%, disproportionately affecting the many. Do I think they will be working regarding the capacity of Mr. Putin to persecute the war? Absolutely not. Already we have seen that Russia's balance of payments are in a huge surplus of $250 billion, because this is no mystery. When you stop importing due to sanctions, but you continue to export gas and oil, including to the European Union, now, we send $700 million every day from the European Union to Mr. Putin, you end up with a huge surplus. And that surplus is allowing Mr. Putin to run his government without any hedge, financially, accounting-wise. And let's also face it, he's a dictator. He doesn't care about his people. So, no, they're not working. If by working you mean impeding his capacity to persecute the war or his will to do so.
In which case do you think we should tighten the screws even further?
Well, I don't believe we can, because I think that President Biden has used the nuclear option. And the nuclear option when it comes to sanctions is the cutting off of the Central Bank of Russia from the international dollarized payment system. Yes, Europe could cease and desist from purchasing natural gas, especially Germany, from the pipeline going under the name of Nord Stream 1. But, you know, that would reduce the flow of dollars into the Russian state coffers. But he would find a way, Putin, that is, of channeling this energy to other countries, to India, to China. So I don't believe that more sanctions are going to slow down the death rate and, the crimes against humanity carried out in Ukraine. I believe that it is absolutely morally pertinent for us to try to find ways of effecting an immediate ceasefire and a withdrawal of the Russian troops, which I'm afraid will involve a kind of negotiation with Mr. Putin that no one would want to have, but everybody must find a way of persecuting.
No, I appreciate that. You can't make peace with your friends. You got to make peace with your enemies, and that often means having unpleasant conversations. But to date, he hasn't shown any interest that I can see that he's interested in having negotiations the likes of which you just described. So what do we do?
Well, there are ongoing negotiations between Ukraine and Russia. They're not getting anywhere. And I believe that, I always believe that from day one, from the 24th of February, that none of these negotiations can ever get us anywhere because you cannot have an effective binding agreement between somebody like President Zelensky, who is the president of the country that has been invaded and therefore the weak link in this negotiation, and some autocrat like Putin on the other. The negotiation that must happen is one between Joe Biden and Vladimir Putin. Putin needs to be given a way out, not because we want to give him a way out. I would very much like to see him, get his comeuppance. But if we want to end this conflict now, there has to be a negotiation between Washington and Moscow. This has not happened. Every time I hear Joe Biden talk about genocide or dragging Putin through a criminal court, what I see is a signal coming from Washington that there will be no negotiation. And I don't believe that Washington has the ethical right to sacrifice Ukrainians on behalf of some moral drive to see Putin come down, because Putin will not come down. He's not going to be brought down in less than 5, 6, 7, 8 years by a combination of sanctions and more of a war of attrition. And I don't think we have the right to inflict upon Ukrainians another 5, 6 years of this. We do not have the right to turn Ukraine into an Afghanistan in the European Union's periphery. Because even though some people say to me, but look, the Mujahideen in Afghanistan in the end defeated the Soviets. Yes, but look at Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. It's a cesspit of malignancy. In the end, it's an ungovernable and destroyed place. We do not want this for the Ukraine.
Well, let me ask you about the post-Cold War world, because, of course, 30-plus years ago, I guess the prevailing wisdom was, if we have added economic integration between the West and Russia, then surely that will keep the peace, because, after all, nobody wants to invade a country that you're doing business with. Clearly, that theory has fallen apart. Do you think it was a mistake in hindsight to be so dependent on Russian fossil fuels?
I do not believe, Steve, that the theory has fallen apart. If anything, with the benefit of hindsight, the West should be self-critical and understand that it never gave that theory a chance. Let me remind you that after 1991, Russia was on its knees. You had Yeltsin, you had in the prime ministership of Russia and in the government of Russia, liberal reformists. Why were they crushed? They were crushed because the International Monetary Fund and Washington insisted on a policy of exacting a pound of flesh from the Russian economy in the form of debt repayments that the Russian economy was simply not prepared to make. Let me remind you that between 1995 and 1998, Russia was pushed into a major financial crisis by the West. The IMF brought Russia to its knees in 1998. Let me remind you that because of this policy by the International Monetary Fund in Washington, the life expectancy of men in Russia fell from 78 to 56 years of age. This has never happened in any country in the world in such a short space of time. To have this crushing effect on an economy, a society. It is my considered opinion that the monster that goes by the name Vladimir Putin was bred in the guts of this gigantic humiliation of the Russian people that was affected by the denial to the Russian people of the opportunity to join the global economy. So, it is time that Washington takes a very good look at itself in the mirror and understand that it's not that integrating the Russian economy didn't work. It was the choice of Washington and in particular the International Monetary Fund in association with Washington, D.C. It was the choice not to integrate Russia that gave rise to Putin, the oligarchs, and gave the impetus to a process by which Russia became the villain of the peace.
Is it also fair to say, though, that because countries like Germany are so dependent on Russian oil and gas to keep the lights on, that in effect, the West is in a perverse way funding some of this war?
True, entirely. But it's a combination of the two things, what you say and what I say. On the one hand, you crush a society like Russia, a proud people like the Russians. You crush them. The West crushed them. Remember, Putin, when he first became president, even suggested that Russia joins NATO. And he was turned away. And his economy was crushed. So a combination of humiliating them, humiliating a nuclear power, not a very clever thing to do, while at the same time relying on them, as you said quite correctly, for gas and oil. This is a policy made in hell. It's a policy that whoever has devised it needs to have their head examined collectively.
All right, let me set up my next set of questions by reading this excerpt from something Patty Hirsch did on The Indicator by Planet Money. This is an NPR podcast, and it goes like this. Some observers are saying that Russia has essentially created a Potemkin currency. This is a reference to Grigory Potemkin, who was appointed governor of Crimea after Catherine the Great annexed it in 1784. Eager to show Catherine how successful he had been in resettling Crimea with Russian villagers, Potemkin supposedly built and populated a mobile village that he assembled, disassembled, and then reassembled along her route as she inspected the region. The head of the Central Bank of Russia, Elvira Nabiullina, is essentially playing Potemkin to Putin's Catherine, using a range of tools to make the ruble look like a currency that has value, when in fact very few people outside Russia want to buy a single ruble unless they absolutely have to, and when many people inside Russia don't really want rubles either. Okay, what are the range of tools that the central bank has used to prop up the currency during the course of this war? Help us understand that.
While I'm loath to be critical of NPR, because I like NPR, it's one of the few sources of news from the United States, I have to say that what you just read out is a very good example of terrible economic thinking. There is no Potemkin village in the Russian ruble, and proof of that is that since that piece was written on NPR.org, the ruble has risen, and has risen on the back of very fundamental magnitudes. As I said before, the surplus of the balance of payments of the Russian Republic has risen to $250 billion. Now, a currency reflects, the value of a currency reflects whether it's the country's balance of payments is in surplus or in deficit, and to what extent it is in surplus or in deficit. By curtailing imports due to sanctions and massively boosting the revenues of the Russian state from oil and gas, because even if they are selling less oil and gas, the crisis in the energy market has boosted the price of oil and gas to such an extent that their revenues are actually skyrocketing at a time when expenditure on imports has collapsed. So the ruble is backed by fundamentals. This is not a Potemkin ruble. It's the reality of a combination of capital controls, of imports that are diminishing, and of exports whose dollar value is increasing massively.
All right, let's focus on Ukraine. And I mean, this is a shocking number to report, but apparently the Ukrainian economy is going to contract by as much as 40% by the end of the year. The IMF has just said that the international economy is also going to deteriorate significantly because of this war. You have a huge understanding of a contracting economy from your time as the Minister of Finance in Greece. What advice would you give to the Ukrainian finance minister right now?
Sue for peace. We need to end the destruction. Look, GDP numbers do not matter at all when people are dying. When you see a bridge destroyed, what matters is who was on the bridge and who died and who was maimed. The bridge itself doesn't matter, because once peace has been achieved, rebuilding it is going to boost GDP faster than its destruction diminished. By the way, you mentioned the IMF. I have a message for my good friends in Washington, D.C. at the International Monetary Fund. Put your money where your mouth is. If you really care about Ukraine, stop extracting, as we speak, billions of dollars in interest payments from Ukraine's public debt, debt to the IMF. The IMF should restructure, should haircut, should write down the debt of Ukraine instead of insisting of exacting pounds of flesh from the state of Ukraine while the people of Ukraine are struggling to survive. So let's end this hypocrisy. Let's end the war, and let's have the international community, and in particular the European Union, pour billions of euros, of dollars, of yen, whatever, you know, Canadian dollars, into reconstructing the Ukraine.
Is it even possible to recreate any semblance of consumer confidence or tackle inflation if the war continues?
Well, the war is making a bad thing worse. Remember, inflation had returned as a result of the interruption of supply chains during the pandemic at the end of the first lockdown. When we were beginning to imagine or to see the light at the end of the tunnel, of the inflationary tunnel, then the Ukrainian war came and turbocharged what was a pre-existing problem. And before that, let me remind you, since 2008, we've been having a crisis of what I call the great deflation, a great deflationary process whereby financial markets, stock exchanges were doing fabulously because of all the money printing by central banks, but austerity was being imposed upon almost every peoples around the West, North America, the European Union, elsewhere. So this combination of effectively socialism for the bankers and the financial sector and austerity for everybody else was squeezing investment in good quality jobs, in the green transition, in green energy, while at the same time creating fabulous riches for the paper pushers in Wall Street and elsewhere. That was the situation before inflation hit us. Then inflation hit us with the pandemic. It was exacerbated by the Ukrainian war. And now we have the Federal Reserve, the Central Bank of Canada, the Central Bank of Europe, the Bank of England, and so on, in despair, because over the last 13 years, they have they've been keeping the corporate world addicted to cheap finance. So you have the whole of the corporate world of the North Atlantic utterly dependent on the printing presses of our central banks. And now these printing presses have absolutely no answer to the question, how do you maintain a semblance of normality in the corporate sector while pushing inflation down? And the war in Ukraine is preventing even a sensible discussion on how this is going to happen. So the war in Ukraine must end today. It must end because Ukrainians are dying and because more war is not the answer to war. And it must end because the poor all over the world, not just, of course, in Europe and North America, but across the world, with inflation when it comes to food prices in Africa, in Asia, in India, destroying the lives of countless millions of people. So we have a moral duty to end this war.
We have something here in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, called the Hot Docs Film Festival. And you are the subject of a very significant documentary, it's 4 hours long actually, about your political life. It's called In the Eye of the Storm, The Political Odyssey of Yiannis Varoufakis.
Debt is to capitalism that which hell is to Christianity. Unpleasant and essential. Whereas debt was tangential to life before capitalism, with capitalism it becomes the turbocharging unit of production. It's what allowed immense productive resources and capacities and forces to be unleashed by capitalism, the result being the modern world that we live in.
That is a great metaphor about debt. And okay, we understand the unpleasant part about debt, but the essential part of debt, what is that?
Before capitalism, you had production, you know, peasants were working on the land, and they would produce, the harvest would come in, and the lord would send the sheriff to take the lord's cut, to put it simply. And then the lord would sell that cut in open markets near the villages and so on. And that would create financialization, that would give some money to the lord, and the lord would then lend it on to other people. So debt would come at the very end of the line of production and distribution. But with capitalism, what you have is entrepreneurs borrowing in advance, before production begins, to lease land, to lease machines, to pay workers, before any production happened. The order was reversed. Debt came first, then came distribution. You know, this is how much the workers will take, this is how much the banks will take, this is how much the landlords will take, and then came production at the end. That reversal of this order, with debt fueling production, unleashed tremendous powers in the world economy and shaped the modern world. But at the same time, what it did, because it was a good thing, too much of a good thing, allows the ones who controlled it, in other words, the bankers, to enrich themselves fabulously and to want more and more of it. In a sense, humanity under capitalism is borrowing from the future, hoping to be able to repay the future. At some point, when this becomes very profitable, we keep borrowing too much from the future. And then the present cannot repay the future. And then you have a collapse, like we had in 2008, a major event in human history, akin to what happened in 1929. And I do believe that we're still in the same crisis. The one you and I were talking about in 2010, 2011, it has never gone away, really. The war in Ukraine is escalating one of the guises of that crisis that began in 2008. And I'm sure economic historians in the future are going to describe as our generation's 1929. And one of the great fallacies that has been adversely affecting the life of common folk out there is the fallacy of looking and concentrating exclusively on public debt and not looking at private debt. Let me remind our viewers that 2008 was a catastrophe caused not by the federal government in the United States, the federal government in Canada, by the governments of the European Union. It was caused by banks. Banks had gone on to a lending, borrowing, and gambling spree. So it was private debt that exploded in 2008, destroying so many lives and putting us in a never-ending crisis. Now, of course, a private debt crisis can very easily morph into a public debt crisis, because when the state has to bail out the banks, like it happened, for instance, in Ireland, in Spain, in the United States, for that matter, in the United Kingdom, then suddenly you have a problem of public debt. But the public debt was simply the morphing of the private debt. So we need to look at the debt in total, private and public, and to ask ourselves a question. Is it sustainable? That is this debt or a substantial portion of it going into investment into the things that humanity needs? Unfortunately, since 2008, the answer is a big neon light lit no. If you look at the way we have wasted trillions and trillions of US dollars of printed money, money that did not go into the green energy which we need and which would have decoupled us from Vladimir Putin's Gazprom, just as an example, or indeed from the very dirty energy produced by Canada, by the United States through fracking and so on. We would have had all the green energy we needed had we invested over the last 13, 14 years, even a fraction of the amount of money that was borrowed or printed by central banks. This is the issue. Is the debt turning into investments, into things that we need, not things we don't need, but things we need.
All right, let me return to the documentary for a moment, because you tell another very good story in the documentary about an encounter with Larry Summers, the former U.S. Treasury Secretary, in which he basically describes two different kinds of politicians, insiders and outsiders. And you clearly saw yourself as an outsider, but I wonder if, at looking back at all of your time in public life, whether had you been an insider, you may have been able to achieve more. What do you think?
Oh, certainly not. I would have achieved more for my own personal career and enrichment. There's no doubt about that. I was ejected from the corridors of power 6 months after I became finance minister because I wasn't going to sign on the dotted line of things that would have made a bad thing worse for the people of Greece, but also for the people of Europe. What I was told by various high-ranking officials, Larry Summers was not the only one. Christine Lagarde was even more poignant in what she said to me. She said to me that, you know, if I care about my credibility with the insiders, then even though I'm right, I should sign on the dotted line. And I said, I don't care about my credibility. I care about making a difference to the people out there. Had I signed on the dotted line, yes, I would have remained an insider. Could I have made a big difference, a significant difference by having stayed on the inside? No, because the moment you sign on the dotted line, you simply become an apparatchik and you simply continue the same policies that deplete the capacity of humanity to create a viable economy, a viable ecology.
I should ask you whether you've actually seen the documentary about your life. It's 4 hours long, as we suggested. Have you seen the whole thing?
I have to say that I have seen it. Look, if you had asked me the first time we met, I remember, in your studio, whether there would ever be a documentary like that or whether there should be a documentary like that about me, I would have said, it must be crazy. I mean, why should anyone, a cinematographer of the caliber of Raul Martinez, want to do a documentary of me? This is not about me. The reason why I watched it and I helped Raul Martinez produce it, I'm an accidental participant in a broader drama. You would never have heard of me had Europe, the European Union, our countries, my country, not gone bankrupt following the Wall Street collapse. And it so happened that because I didn't sign up on the dotted line, because I didn't become an insider, some people, good people like Raul Martinez, were interested in the story I have to tell, which I think is a universal story. It's not my story. It's a story of how capitalism went belly up in 2008 and how since then central banks and governments have been trying to bail out the financial sector at the expense of the rest of society in a manner which depletes our capacity to create good quality jobs and to invest in averting the climate catastrophe.
That was Yanis Varoufakis on the looming threats in the global economy and the war in Ukraine. He was interviewed by Steve Paikin on Canadian Public TV on April 21st, 2022. Paikin also brought up the four-hour documentary about Varoufakis, just released in May 22 under the title In the Eye of the Storm. The filmmaker Raul Martinez says, in this documentary, Varoufakis raises urgent questions about where our civilization is headed, and he connects economic failure, globalization, democracy, fascism, and the climate crisis. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelöden. Thank you for listening.